Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The relationship between young people and society and the relationship between parents and kids. That's what we're going on or talking about on today's program. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about homelessness among the young. But first, a look at how young people may do as much or more to shape their parents than the other way around. With me in studio is author-journalist Jennifer Senior. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine, but is currently making the rounds, promoting her 2014 book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. It's out now in paperback. Jennifer, nice to have you with us.
Oh, my gosh. So nice to be here.
Well, I know the first thing you want to make clear to our listeners is that this is not a parenting book.
Oh, my God. They can't see me, but I am collapsing in gratitude here in the studio. Yes. I find all those books on the shelf at Barnes & Noble sort of tyrannizing, you know, how to raise a kid. I always look at them and I think that what they're secretly telling me is that I'm doing something wrong. This is a book about how kids affect their parents. It's a reverse angle thing. I don't judge anyone. I don't weigh in on how to do it. I look at how kids are affecting us.
When did the research on this subject flip? I mean, as you've indicated, it's all been about parenting, what parents should do to bring their kids up properly. And now it's been flipped.
Interesting that you ask that. Yeah. It's not like there's an explicit body of literature out there that looks at that, this question in particular. So I had to do a lot of crazy archival spelunking to pull it all together. I had to go into, you know, sociology and psychology and anthropology and history and economics, a little bit of philosophy in order to weave it together. But there is one thing that social scientists have been measuring since the 1950s, and that's how kids affect their parents' happiness. So since the 50s, people have been looking at that question. And what's interesting is that it's a very robust response that they always get, which is that kids seem to negatively affect their parents' happiness. They seem to – that non-parents are happier. And that is really the only consistent thing that you'll find in social science. And to me, it's just kind of baffling and inadequate. I mean, it's demoralizing. It's insufficient. It doesn't tell you very much. But it was that body of literature that got me interested in the question generally. How do kids affect their moms and dads? I mean, okay, they're just saying that they don't affect them well, but do I buy that? And if it's the case, why?
Do you buy it?
I think moment to moment, parents' affect are pretty well compromised. I think we can say that we find that parents moment to moment are more stressed out than non-parents. That seems to be unambiguously true. And it's you can think of a thousand reasons why, but what I would say is, number one, it's not the kids who are the problem, right? It's something about how we parent right now in 2015 that's the problem. And the other thing I'd say is that social science does a lousy job of capturing things like joy and meaning. It doesn't distinguish between kinds of positive emotions. You know, it could, but it doesn't often try to do that. It just says, how are you feeling? Are you okay? Are you not okay? Are you satisfied or not satisfied? It's very blunt instruments that they use.
No, how do you define fun and joy?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. Joy, the way I like to define it, is the way that George Valiant, the psychiatrist up at Harvard, now emeritus, but likes to define it. It's a lovely definition that he uses. He has the soul of a poet, by the way. He says that basically joy is just a transcendent connection or bond to another. But what was profound that he noticed about joy, and this I really love, he said that joy is harder to tolerate than grief. Because if joy is connection, then you have to tolerate the possibility of losing that connection at any moment. So if you think about it, that is exactly why parents are hovering over their kids' cribs, or why when they find out about a new town, a Sandy Hook, you know, some mass shooting, they feel physically ill all day. I mean, that fear is very close to the surface for all of us. And so the way that he put it was that joy is grief inside out. And I think that's perfect and beautiful as aphorisms go.
You know, the Times, you mentioned Sandy Hook, the Times certainly have to play a very distinct role in the whole process, no matter which angle you're looking at it from.
Totally. So, you know, I look at sort of three big ways that modern parenting has really kind of changed in the book. And the way that the book is structured, I also look at how kids affect parents at every stage of their parents' of their development. So how toddlers affect their parents, how kids in the elementary school years affect their parents, and how teenagers affect their parents, because obviously it's very different from them.
A lot less joy during the teenage years, I would have to think.
They are famously unfun. They are the time that, you know, I think Shakespeare said were designed only for wronging the ancient tree.
You know, one of the things that is pointed out by you is the fact that during the teenage years, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves chronologically, but one of the things that's at work here is the fact that women may be at or nearing menopause when these kids are at that stage, and the fathers and mothers too to a degree may be at a stage in their careers that is a little bit touchy or ambiguous at that time.
It's a wonderful point. Yes. So the harmonic harmonious conversions of these things are critically important here. Right. For starters, because if you're a college educated woman, you are deferring having children until you're 30 on average. That means that you're going to be in perimenopause or menopause itself when your kids are teenagers. Mm-hmm. So just as they're becoming, you know, fertile, you're at the end of that cycle. And so, you know, there's this kind of mirroring of kind of hormonal changes, right? Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But more to the point, and I think more crucially, exactly, during adolescence, your kids are pulling away from you. And that's developmentally appropriate. Mm-hmm. But what it means is that at best, they're indifferent to you and they're just kind of politely tolerating your company. But at worst, they're bitterly cataloging everything that they believe you're doing wrong, or they're being very hostile and they're acting out. And what this means is that you are no longer drawing tons of affection and energy from them, right? They're not there to give you that anymore. They're not bounding toward you when you walk through the door after work, right? So you have to draw your strength from other sources in your life. So suddenly you're looking to your marriage for support, or you're looking to your job for support, or your friends or your hobbies. And that's when you first notice, oh my God, my husband hasn't really been very nice to me for the last 3 years. Mm. Or, oh my God, the woman I'm working with isn't very kind. She doesn't ever act together, whatever it is. You're noticing all these things. And it can be a real crisis because your kids are now sort of exposing all the holes in your life now that they're not giving you that affection. That tends to be what I hear a lot from the parents of adolescents.
It's not a parenting book, but what's the advice to parents who are dealing with this? I mean, there are a lot of questions, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't actually – my book is not prescriptive, right? It's descriptive. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully people will feel – and this is what I hear all the time from readers, that it's just nice to be recognized and to have someone diagnosing what's going on and just to have it – have a name for what it is. But if you squint, one of the things you can see in that chapter, for instance, is people who have hobbies do a lot better, right? Because mm-hmm. they have some other source of fulfillment. People who have kind of – women, let's say, who have stepped away from the workforce, but now their kids are rejecting them and they've staked so much on their kids. Women who sort of thought to reenter their workforce when their kids were like 8 or 9 and have something to go back to, some other source of kind of meaning – are often in a better position to do well, right? Those are things that one could suggest.
You're mentioning women, and your focus is on women, but there are fathers in the equation too.
Oh, yes. So fathers, here's what I would say if we're still going to be dwelling on the adolescence chapter.
For a moment.
Yeah, let's stay there for a second because it's one of my – it is my favorite chapter, truthfully. So fathers – contrary to what one might expect, according to the data, fathers are more depressed than mothers when their kids leave the house. And here's why. Women all along have had this kind of intuitive sense of what's been going on, right? They're on the receiving end, much more so than dads, of all the kids' wrath because they're spending more time with the kids. They're on the ground, right? They're the first responders. So they've been attuned to the emotional rhythms of the house all along. So when their kids leave, although they're incredibly sad, they're also relieved on some level because it's been hard and they've been absorbing a lot of arrows. Fathers are sort of brought up short, right? And they're – so, you know, I can't remember who coined the term empty den syndrome for the men.
Oh, really?
Which, yeah, I don't know. All these terms kind of make me break out in a rash slightly. But anyway, so for men, I think the idea might be to sort of be intensify their involvement so that they're less startled by the abruptness of the departure when their kids finally go.
You talked to a lot of people put together all of this.
Oh, yeah.
Did you find you're a parent?
Yeah.
How old are your kids?
So I was only allowed one of my own. He's 7. Because when I entered the scene, my husband had a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old. So I've lived through 0 to 7, and I've lived through 12 to 25. I don't know what the middle years look like. I hear they're lovely. No, I do.
Did you find yourself amongst the interviews and amongst the things you determined?
No, I decided I didn't want myself to be in the book or my son. There's a lot of stuff in the memoir genre out there, and I wanted this to be research-based.
But I mean by finding yourself, did you
oh,
the things
sorry.
That people were experiencing, things that you have
yes, I'm so sorry. Of course, I understood your question 10 seconds after I gave the wrong answer. Yes, yes, totally. There was something deeply therapeutic about seeing my own experiences reflected back at me and then having an excuse to go back and look into the literature. So I'll give an example because, of course, I started researching this book when my kid was 2. And there is this, it turns out, very robust body of literature out there that looks at how well kids listen at that age and how often mothers and fathers are essentially nagging kids to behave. It's called like compliance literature, I think is the term, or compliance data. So how often they listen to requests. And the answer is like never. Kids don't listen, right? If you have a toddler, odds are you're going to be issuing a request for them to listen to you basically anywhere from every 90 seconds to every 3 minutes. And they're going to be complying basically 50% of the time. So if you are a parent and you think you are a major league nag, no, you aren't. You're doing what every other mother and father in the United States is doing. You know, you're being a cop. And your kid is not being defiant, you know, or running afoul of any particular toddler laws by not listening to you. That's what they do.
You know, a lot of the research that you looked at came from overseas, a lot of it from the UK, correct? A fair amount from what I'm able to determine.
The only UK stuff that I looked at was that they had some data that corresponded in the beginning to, you know, parents being less happy than non-parents. But the UK data that I looked at also, when I was looking at comparative levels of foreign happiness levels of mm-hmm. parents abroad. So, no, mm-hmm. I tried to steer clear. I'm trying to think of what you might be thinking of. Maybe it'll come to us.
It was the happiness factor,
the happiness stuff.
To be sure. But
definitely.
What I was getting at is that relevant here? I mean, do we match each other
right.
in these areas?
Right. So that, yes. Okay. So let's go to the foreign data. Here is what I found interesting. The UK is interesting. Even more interesting would be places like France, places like Denmark. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, there is a huge disparity in happiness levels between parents and non-parents. Non-parents win. They're more happy. This doesn't necessarily mean, by the way, that they're more fulfilled or that they have the same highs and the same lows. Parents, I think, have more highs and more lows than non-parents and probably have more meaning. But in France, for instance, and then when you get to the Scandinavian countries, all this switches places. And the parents become happier than non-parents in those places because the social safety net is much, much thicker. French parents and also in all the Scandinavian countries, they don't have to worry about subsidized child care. They don't have to worry about paid maternity and paternity leave. They have it. They don't have to worry about health care or about good university educations being free or being costly. I mean, all these things are taken care of by the state, and it significantly reduces parents' anxiety. It makes them a lot happier.
The pressure is off.
Off.
The pressure is off. Our guest in studio is Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun. She'll be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library. That's on Lindbergh, just south of Highway 40. We'll come back and continue our conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you would like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back in a moment with Jennifer Senior. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Jennifer Senior. You know, Jennifer, these times are so much different, as we alluded to earlier. But what I'm thinking of in particular is the impact that social media, the internet, whole online thing is having on the relationship between parents and their children.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and there are several ways to look at that, too. One is just to look at parents comparing themselves to other parents, right? The kind of peer-to-peer anxiety that parents might feel, where they look on Facebook and think they're doing everything wrong because every other family looks so happy, which, of course, is fake. You know, we all aggressively curate our Facebook feed to look like our family lives are bright and shiny and perfect, when in fact, like everything, they are rough on one side and smooth on the other. So that's one thing. That is another public way of kind of showing one's plumage. And by the way, you know, we have so few ways to publicly show that we are moral people now. I talk about this in the book. You know, it used to be we could be civic leaders. We could take care of our aging parents. We could volunteer. We don't do any of that now. We place all of that energy into parenting. And I think it's misplaced. It's this kind of showy way. So Facebook is like an unfortunate forum for that, a big platform for it. The other thing that I think you're also talking about is your kid now leads this life apart, particularly, you know, starting at a certain age, if they're kind of on Facebook themselves or they have their own iPhone. And that is a very big and modern conundrum for a parent. And I talk about this a great deal, too. I mean, when I was a kid, if my mother wanted to know who I was talking to on the phone, she just had to answer it. Mm-hmm. And if she wanted to know what television I was watching, she just had to step into the den, right? That was it. And she could passively monitor everything. And now you can't passively monitor your kids. So you have to make this conscious determination, this decision, that you're going to actively do it, mm-hmm. that you're going to spy. And that's crossing a Rubicon that many kids find unwelcome and many parents themselves find very creepy. But, you know, you probably have to do it, and you have to find a way to start that conversation early. I have the right to inspect what is on your hard drive, you know?
You say that parents are putting all of their energy into parenting. I would suggest that maybe not so much anymore, that they're content, many of them, to have the iPad and the television set and the cell phone take care of that job for them.
You know, it's a funny thing because on the one hand, sure. On the other hand, not so much, because I'll tell you something. Today, mothers spend more time with their kids than they did in the 1960s. 4 more hours per week. Even if you are a mom in the workforce, you spend 2 more hours per week.
That surprises the heck out of me.
Now, I'll tell you why. I can explain it to you. Mm-hmm. So the American Time Use Survey data on this is very, very clear. Back in the 60s, moms had to keep impeccable houses. So what they did was they spent all of their time buffing the floors to a high shine. There was no more ring around the collar. Dinners were splendid and scrumptious and punctual. But they put their kids in playpens. And when their kids came home from school, they told them to go onto bikes and that they were not going to see them until dinner time when they banged a gong, right? That was it. Today, women don't clean their houses at all. You know, their houses are filthy. They don't know how to cook. This is according to the same American Time Use Survey data.
We'll get a few calls on that one, Jerry.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, I'm just saying on average. This might not apply to you, but on average, our houses are the ones that are being neglected, not our kids. Women go off to work and they spend a ton of time with their kids. And it's showing up as play and as time with children or as time chauffeuring them back and forth. It's not showing up as kids being on their iPads. Women are spending with their kids 4 more hours per week. It's the house that gets the neglect.
But we hear so much about, and families don't even sit down and eat together anymore. The kids and the parents at dinner time are not together.
That's totally true. And there's a moment in my book where I actually say, I have a quote, a woman in Texas saying that homework is the new dinner, right? But what that means is moms and dads are doing the homework with the kids rather than having dinner. The dinner table has been given over to school supplies. Everybody's eating takeout in 10 minutes and then concentrating on their school assignments.
Is that the joy part or the fun part?
I would say that that's the no fun part. I want to go solidly with the second half of my title on that one.
Let's bring a caller into the discussion here. We'll bring in Amanda calling from St. Louis. Amanda, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I feel so indicted by the filthy house, but lovingly tended
no, you
to
should
child.
Feel, no,
it's
no,
so true.
You should feel liberated by that, you and everyone else.
I feel completely at home with
vindicated.
My basically average peers.
Vindicated, yes.
I wanted to, I have a first grader and about to be a one-year-old in about 2 weeks, so, and I'm 42, we're getting to the game late. But I wanted to bring up a point that I thought was really interesting when I read your book. And I will say this. I checked the book out of the library, and I just stared at it because I could never get myself psyched up. Like, ooh, all joy, no fun. Let me read that in my spare time. And I renewed it up to the renewal limit and then had to return it and then checked it on our audio to let you read it to me. So it's just much better that way. But I kind of thought making it through the baby years that we would be, like, on the downward slope, you know, because I find them very challenging physically, mentally, emotionally, all of that. And I was terrified when I read on and found out that really the teen years are when the stress pushes your marriage to the breaking point and relationships to the breaking point with your kids. And informally surveying, my friends tell me now this is true. So I'm completely freaked out all over again.
Well, I mean, I don't think I ever used the word pushing people to the breaking point.
Is my interpretation.
Right. I mean, I would posit that that might be a slightly like disastrous or, you know, slightly dim view of those years. It's true that, you know, here's what I will say about the adolescence chapter. People who are very far south of it, who have like only say first graders, mm-hmm. look at that chapter and wig out. Whereas people who are parents of adolescents love that chapter more than anything else in the book and think that there's something really freeing about reading it and seeing everybody see, like, yep, this is what it looks like. Because I think maybe if I had to do the redo, I would have written one paragraph making clear, adolescents are awesome. I mean, they're proto people. And I do say that they are proto people and that they do start to, you know, while you weren't looking, they suddenly became moral and actually will think to ask you how you're feeling if you're sick. You know, that they do start to notice the world and others and stuff in spite of their, you know, adolescent rep for being total narcissists. So there is something about it that's really intoxicating, like noticing that you have a full person with a full functioning brain in front of you. So I wouldn't like necessarily panic. I mean, I think there's some of the most thrilling years too. It's just that the stakes are high because they're proto people, you know, for all the same reasons that they are terrific. They are also high things. The stakes are now, you know, you're not fretting about whether the kid likes peas. You know, you're fretting about whether or not the kid is hanging out with people who are doing and saying the right things and leading them toward good stuff or bad stuff. Right. It's other concerns.
Well, I will say the idea of a forming person who notices something besides himself is sort of appealing. So maybe that'll be the upside.
Oh, yeah. And also all the years in between. I mean, the so-called latency year. I mean, 6 to 12 is also really charming, you know, and it's fairly tranquil. I mean, you spend a lot of time carpooling, but, you know, and cultivating them. But, you know, I think that's the other thing about adolescence that, you know, it's a very abrupt transition from the tranquil years that preceded it, right? So it's a rude shock to parents, I think, sometimes. But
well, I really loved your book, and
Thank you.
As much as it, like, as the chapters went on, I kept sort of riding the emotional roller coaster. But I actually plan to read it again with my own eyeballs now because I kept thinking there were things I wanted to go back to, which, you know, it's hard on audio sometimes.
Oh, thank you. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, the title is definitely, you know, I had to decide, was I going to run with it, you know? And we just decided we were going to do it because it said so much so quickly. But it's
right.
True that many people are a little put off by the no fun part, thinking I mean it literally and that there's never any fun. And of course, there's tons of fun in parenting.
No, it's the days are long and the years are short, right?
Exactly.
Same idea. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
We keep coming back to adolescence, but we had an interesting discussion here yesterday with a gentleman who's written a book about wanting to have the discussion about sex with your kids.
Oh, yeah.
And he basically says start at age 5 because when you get to that adolescence period, you're not going to say anything to the kids that they don't already know in today's world.
Oh, absolutely. And also, I mean, my kid at 7 has figured out how to YouTube things on his own. Now, because he's only 7, he doesn't have like an adolescent boy's curiosities. But I was astonished to learn how quickly and how facile they become with
As an adoptive parent, do you find that the dynamic is any different?
You know, it's funny. There's a main character in this book named Sharon who had an adoptive kid, who adopted a kid. And actually, there are a number now that I think about it. You know, I didn't actually ask them to. I mean, everybody feels like, you know, I'm sure that there are a million wonderful books to write about this. And, you know, I don't want to pass myself off as an expert on this. So I don't feel totally qualified to answer that. But I'll say one thing. Alison Gopnik had this great line. She's a psychologist and a philosopher. She said at one point in one of her books, we don't care for our kids because we love them. We love our kids because we've cared for them. So just think about that in terms of adoption. Yeah. You know, this kid comes to you helpless, and over time you grow to love them.
Yeah.
So
it's a great line. It's a great line. Let's take one more call before we have to say goodbye. We'll bring in Ken, calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Ken.
Hi, Don and Jennifer. Great segment as always. I've just been listening and so much of what's been said is, you know, a reflection back at me, and it's amazing. Of all the things, and I could comment on 100, that I wanted to ask about was my observation, which was it was really a negative aspect about child rearing, and I have great kids, was this incredible increase in competitiveness in terms of amongst children. Pretty much, I think it starts kind of being forced on by parents, actually, and I'm talking about sports, athletic, and social endeavors.
Yep.
It's just, I stayed out of it as much as I could, but I mean, it had an impact, and I just wanted to know if that was part of, if anything was included in your book about that. I definitely plan to pick it up and read it.
The answer is all of chapter 4, about 20,000 words. You'll have, and in fact, because you're, of course, isolating something that, you know, all of us are reckoning with in this huge way, and I'm so grateful you brought it up. So chapter 4 in my book is all about what the sociologist Annette LaRue calls concerted cultivation, which is about this unbelievable kind of effort that we all make to cultivate our children within an inch of their little lives, shuttling them to and from violin lessons and sports practice and traveling leagues. And you know, we're probably doing the violin too because it's Suzuki. And, you know, our weekends are completely monopolized by these things. And so if you look at this, if you pull the camera way back and you look at this with a little bit more perspective, up until very, very recently, kids worked. They actually were economic assets to their families. And only really after World War II did they cease to become – did they cease to be that. So one of my favorite sociologists said that kids became economically useless and emotionally priceless. And so our jobs as parents became – suddenly, in fact, I'm going to go further. They weren't just economically useless. They became expensive. Right. We now, our sole job, they don't work for us. We basically work for them now. Right. So our sole job now as parents is to shelter them, to educate them, and to make them as ready for the future as possible. But here's the problem. We don't know what the heck the future is going to look like because the world is changing at this rapid clip. So what we all do as conscientious parents is sign them up for everything, hoping that one thing will work and stick and be of some use. And that is probably, to some degree, what you are staring at right now.
Boy, you give us an awful lot to chew on, Jennifer Senior. Thank you so much for being with us. I know you've got a full schedule today because you're going to be back at the St. Louis County Library at 7 o'clock tonight.
I am indeed.
Talking about the book, All Joy and No Fun. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the book, and I'm sure you'll have a full house tonight.
Thank you so much. This has been all joy. It's been delicious. Thank you.
Well, for us too. That's Thanks. Jennifer Senior. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about youth in another perspective. And that is homeless youth. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU.